Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Doing things you don't like is good for you. I had to do all kinds of things to survive. I sold franchises for swimming pools. I wrote parts of books for people. I wrote parts of a book about evolution of the American cowboy. I wrote a book about how the Bugatti motor car. I wrote part of a book on the world weather. I wrote part of a guidebook for London. I wrote speeches for the chairman of Imperial Foods. I wrote presentations for the Ford Motor Company. I sold investments on the telephone. I did every bloody thing and anything that people asked me to do to make money, and I hated a lot of it, but by God, it was good for me.
I like your intro here, how you wrote, Oscar Wilde said that the experience is the name we give our mistakes, and I'm extremely experienced. That's not just because I'm very old, it's because, like most creative people, I love to try new things, and quite a few have been stupid or crazy. Of course, some have been sensible, but everyone has a story attached, and everyone has led to a revelation, a valuable lesson. So I'm glad you're going to pass these on to me. Let's start with the first one, and it's my first job in advertising when you learn hardly anyone studies, but you did. Tell me, what does that mean?
I walked out of university. In fact, my father never forgave me because I got a scholarship to quite a good university. And at the end of the first year, I was doing the Spanish oral, and the lady who was conducting the exam said, obviously in Spanish, ¿Y cómo le gusta la universidad? Which means, and how do you like the university? And I said, no me gusta mucho, which means I don't like it very much. So she said, really? I said, yes. She said, what are you going to do? So I said, I'm going to leave. She said, you're going to leave? I said, yes, I'm going to leave right now.
What year was that, your first year?
Oh, that was my first year, the end of my first year. And I said, I'm going to go and get a job. I want to write. I've always wanted to write, and I'm going to get a job as a writer. And then I went away and got a job as a journalist. But unfortunately, I was making no money at all. And as I said originally, being creative, I like to try things. And one of the things I'd tried was sex. So I have a child and a wife and no money. A friend of mine who was actually very well connected, he was a friend of the royal family, who seemed to be doing extremely well in advertising. And he said, you do well in advertising. And, you know, I mean, I was aware of advertising. I knew what advertising was. But it never occurred to me that you could make money after it.
How old were you at this time?
23. I then went and took an advertising course. And at the end of the first sort of semester, I went to the guy who was teaching it, and I said, look, I'm bloody desperate. I need money desperately. I need to get a job in advertising. And he said, well, I can't really help you. And then he said, but I know somebody who might help you. So I went and got an interview with a man. I remember his name to this day, Arthur Fashion. And we're going back over 50 years. And I have to say, I use low cunning. I think low cunning is a very, very underrated commodity. After I've been talking to him for a while, I picked up one thing very early on, that when you're being interviewed for a job, it is the opportunity of the person who is interviewing you to express themselves, because they're far more interested in themselves than they are in you. So I gathered very quickly this man was a rather right-wing conservative guy. So I came out very quickly with some right-wing conservative views. And he said, you seem a very intelligent young man. I'll get you an interview with this agency in Liverpool. I lived in a place called Manchester, which is in the north, and Liverpool was about 40 miles away.
And were you married with a child?
I was married with a child. I was so poor that we were the only people on our row who had a bath. And the people used to come and borrow our bath. We had an outside toilet. I was very poor. I went and got an interview with this man in Liverpool, and he said, so what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a copywriter. And he said, we don't employ people as copywriters. They have to go through the ranks.
How did you even know that term, copywriting, at 23 then?
My friend, Sandy Ratcliffe, the posh friend, had told me. And what I'd done was I'd gone to the Manchester Public Library, and I read all the books on advertising. in an evening because there were only two.
Which ones were they?
I know what one of them was. It was called Copy the Core of Advertising, and it was written by a man called Aesop Glim. It was actually a nom de plume. It wasn't his real name. He was an editor for a magazine called Printers, Inc. And I read this book, and I remember to this day, he explained how writing copy, imagine there is a canoe going down the middle of a river, and you're on the bank, and you have to find some way of attracting the attention of the people in the canoe and getting them to come to your side of the bank. And I thought, wow, this is all about writing to persuade people to do things. And I'd always wanted to write, but the other thing I was interested in was I wanted to be a lawyer. And I realized that this combined my interest in writing with my interest in persuasion. And so I was immediately obsessed with becoming a copywriter. But when I went to see this man in Liverpool, he said, oh, no, no, we don't hire people like that. He said, why should I give you a job anyhow? And I said, well, I will give you three reasons. The first reason is that I was brought up in a pub. And if you're brought up in a pub, you see people at their best and their worst. And when they've had a few drinks, you really understand human nature. So I understood human nature. And I said, the second reason is that I can write. I've been writing for 2.5 years now, which I had been doing, because I was the assistant editor of this little magazine. And the third reason is that I have a vast knowledge about all sorts of things. And I think these three things qualify me to be a copywriter. So he said, really? He said, tell me, he said, what's the difference between the way a two-stroke engine works and the way a four-stroke engine works? And happily, I knew, and I told him. And he said, And he said, what's the name of the Plymouth Evening newspaper? And I guessed and was wrong. But he asked me 10 questions, and then he said, you do indeed have a fund of knowledge. I might hire you. He said, look, how much are you getting paid now? And I said, well, after tax, £6.13 a week, which is about $3. And he said, all right, I'll pay you that. So I said, the trouble is I've got to come all the way from Manchester. I've got to pay my train fare. So he said, all right, I'll pay you £2 extra. So I used to get up every morning very early, about 6 o'clock, and I would take the train to Liverpool, and I would work in Liverpool. I used to go to the Liverpool market, and I would buy tins of Spam and cheese and bread. And that's what I lived on during the week. I was a very, very rebellious person, you know, really unconventional. And after a while, I was called in, and I was told I didn't really fit in. But the thing that I'd noticed when I got there, and this was my first revelation, was that nobody in the advertising business really studied it. But I was reading books all the time. Every time I could find a book on advertising, I would read it. And I hated the way that in advertising people just guessed what would happen. They didn't study what worked and what didn't work. And I was fascinated to know what worked and didn't work and why. And this is one of the books that influenced me enormously. But my first real surprise was that this is a business full of amateurs. And I thought, well, I may not be a genius, but by God, I can do better than most of this lot. When after a while I was told off for being unconventional, for wearing fancy waistcoats and for swearing and for saying rude things about the vice chairman. And actually, I can remember my boss said to me, and this shows you how long ago it was. He said, we like our young men to wear a hat. And I thought, sod this. I wrote my first really effective piece of direct mail. I wrote letters to 5 advertising agencies in Manchester telling them why they should hire me. And I got job offers from 3 and moved straight ahead into Manchester. I was there for a while, but my dream was to go to London, where the big money was. And eventually, I started writing to agencies in London. And I got interviews. I nearly had a nervous breakdown, to be honest. I made myself very ill because I kept on turning down money. I was offered 50% more than I was getting, and then 80% more than I was getting, but I kept on saying, no, no, I want more. And eventually, just by sticking to my guns, I got paid 2.5 times as much money for doing half as much work.
So what's the lesson in this where hardly anyone studied, but you did?
I don't think this is just true of advertising. Now, I've been in business for many, many years. I think that most people in most businesses do not study sufficiently. They make it up as they go along. I've written a few books, and there's another book I'm thinking of writing, which is just called Marketing for Results. And I was thinking about it today, and I was thinking about how I would begin it. And I would say, you may think that Marketing for Results is a strange title. You would imagine that nobody markets for any other reason. But this is not the case. A great deal of marketing is just done because people say, let's do some marketing, or because somebody likes to see their name in print, or also they might win an award or whatever, but not for results. So I thought, this is an interesting business. Nobody studies, nobody's interested in results, or certainly not as much as I thought they should be. And then when I went and applied for jobs my second revelation was that asking for a little more usually pays. And this lesson was underlined in a startling way, because after I'd been in my first job, which was just an agency, which was bought by the big American advertising agency, somebody came along to me and said, would you like to interview for the job of copy chief at CPV International? And that was a very, very famous name in London.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's Hard to Find Seminars. Let me just ask you, get a little bit of a timeline. That first job, how long were you there before they asked you to leave?
I was there for 14 months.
14 months. And you learned a lot in that first job?
I learned mostly by studying.
All right, so then they wanted you to leave, and then you wrote...
They didn't want me to leave. They just annoyed me.
They annoyed you. So you quit, and you wanted more money and maybe a better job.
I wanted to go back to Manchester. I didn't want to be in a job where people told me what to do. I wanted to do things my own way. First job in Manchester, actually, oddly enough, very strange. After I'd been there for about 2 months, the boss called me in, and he said, Drayton, he said, we're thinking of starting a public relations division, and you seem like a good man for the job. How do you feel about that? So I said, I'm not very keen. So he said, why? And I said, well, because I think the difference between advertising and public relations is like the difference between lying and perjury. He looked at me and he said, well, it's either that or you're going to have the sack. So I said, I'll do public relations, Mr. Knowles, which is his name. And I did public relations for about 6 months. And then he called me in again and he said, it's not really working. I think we're going to have to fire you. So I started laughing. He said, why are you laughing? It's not funny, I'm serious. So I said, what do you want me to do? So he said, well, anyhow, he said, I think it would be a great shame to lose a bright young lad like you to the north, which is where I was. They didn't like people going down to London. And so I've arranged for you to have an interview next door. And I got an interview with the biggest agency outside Manchester.
What were they called?
This was called Osborne Peacock, and they eventually became McCann Erickson. I went next door, had an interview, and the man who interviewed me said, you seem quite bright. I'll arrange for an interview with the creative director. And I went in to see the creative director, a man called Keith Bride. And he said to me, so tell me, he said, what are your views on advertising? And I talked to him for an hour, and he said, look, we don't really have a job for you, but I'll make room for you. And then somebody came in after me to talk to the creative director, who told me after that the creative director said to him, I've just had a young lad in here who knows a lot more about advertising than I do. So it really paid off, all that study, at that point. And at that point, I then started working on big accounts, a big soap company, a big company that sold cleaning material, all sorts of things.
Were you doing the campaigns and writing the copy?
I was writing the copy, yeah. I wrote one line of copy, which, if you mention it today to people, not even in my generation, it was made into a jingle which ran for years and years and years. And you start singing it to people and they all laugh and say, oh, I remember that. And I say, well, I'm the bloke that wrote that. And not a great deal to claim for one's life's work, but I did. Again, I was very rebellious. One day my boss came and he said to me, I was sitting there doing nothing. And he said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. And he said, why are you doing nothing? And I said, because you've given me nothing to do. He said, well, you should go and look for work to do. I said, I'm not bloody running this place. You are. Now, I'll tell you something, Michael. I was wrong. I was wrong, wrong, wrong. Arrogant and wrong. Because the truth is, if you want to succeed, you've got to go looking for work. And when eventually I was employing other people, the people that I valued most were not the people who came, who ignored me and sat around scratching their bottoms. They were the people who went out and found things to do or came up to me and said, is there any way I can help? But I was very arrogant and I had a row with the guy. He had 5 copywriters in that agency and I persuaded 3 of the others and myself to get other jobs. In one case, I actually wrote the letter for him, and eventually he was left with 1 copywriter. As I left, I went to him and I said, look, next time you pick a fight, don't pick a fight with me. I went to London.
All right, let me ask you this. You say you grew up in pubs. Tell me, what do you mean by that?
A pub, a public house, you know, the English pub.
Yeah. You hung out in pubs, like, when you were younger and stuff.
No, my parents had a pub.
Oh, your parents owned a pub. Okay.
Not only did they own a pub, they owned a very good pub. And when suddenly the English started getting interested in food in the 1950s, the thing that really changed the face of British food a lot was the thing called the Good Food Guide, and they were in that Good Food Guide right from the first year. And in fact, the first money I ever actually made was cooking when I was 16. But the thing about a pub, this particular pub was unusual in that it was in a fund fundamentally working class area, but it had a lot of wealthy clientele, so there was a very mixed clientele. So one day I would be talking to some very, very rich cotton businessman, because cotton was the big industry there, and 10 minutes later I'd be talking to a guy who worked in his mill, who was in the other side of the bar. So I had a tremendous perspective of human nature and understanding of human nature. My parents didn't mind me going into the bar and listening to conversations and so on. I must have had it innately anyhow, but I developed this great interest in human nature. And of course, the kind of people we are is determined to a large extent by background and heredity. And in terms of heredity, my father and my grandfather were both fantastic salespeople, so there was selling in my blood anyhow. My father and my grandfather, again, were both extremely literate, so there was writing in my blood. All came out, the right background, the right set of circumstances, the right influences, and a certain amount of oddity on my part, I suspect.
When you were in your first advertising jobs and you got a look at how an agency was run, what were your initial impressions, especially being rebellious, and what were your opinions on it? Did you think it was legit or a lot of fluff?
Well, to be honest, I was rather disappointed. I didn't think it was very imaginative. I was quite surprised that it wasn't really fluffy. It was pretty down to earth. The way they operated then was quite different to the way that they operate now, in the sense that I would sit in my little desk and I would write the copy, and then I would hand it to the art director or designer, or visualizer as they call them then, and then he would do the layout. We didn't really work together. That was a strange thing. The other thing was that I really did educate myself. I had one other guy who worked with me who was also interested in learning. It's rather sad, actually, because I didn't keep in touch with him very much, but I've communicated with him in the last few years once or twice. He never went anywhere. He just stayed in Liverpool doing what he did. He never had a go. He never had a go, whereas I wanted to have a go. I wanted to be successful. But no, it wasn't fluffy at all. It was just dull in that first agency. Well, the second one was really a little proprietorial business. The third one, the big one, they were pretty good. But again, it was very down to earth.
Were these agencies making a lot of money?
Oh, yeah. The first one was making good money. The second was a bit of a hobby. The guy also ran a restaurant. It was quite a small agency with only about 20 people. The third one, but maybe 100 and odd people, they were making a ton of money. They were the biggest agency outside London. And in those days, you could make a ton of money. You can tell by the kind of cars the chairman was driving, which was a Rolls Royce.
Where did the money come from?
The agency business was a cushy business, because the agency business grew out of the people who sold advertising on commission. This is how the advertising agency business started in America and in England. What happened was you had representatives who went out selling space for newspapers. After a while, they realized that if they were going to sell more space, it was a good idea to help the advertiser get results from his advertising. So they would say, oh, I will prepare the advertisement for you. And eventually they sort of switched over from representing the newspaper to representing the advertiser, and they got their 15% commission. And the thing is, you got that 15% commission. If you ran, say, for one of our clients, Imperial Leather, which is the biggest selling soap in Britain, if I wrote an ad for Imperial Leather, that ad would run for a year, and every time it ran, we'd get 15%. And it wasn't until, I would say, the late 70s, that system started to break down when advertisers realised that, you know, this is ridiculous and they didn't have to pay that kind of money. And they started beating agencies down on price. But it was a wonderful business for those people at that time.
Back then, before the 70s, was it accountable advertising? So if they're running that ad year after year, would the agency measure and be able to show a return on investment for their advertising dollar spent?
That's an extremely good question. And the answer to that is, and this is really what determined the shape of my career, there were two types of client. There were the clients who did measure their results and the clients who didn't. And I was fascinated by the clients who did. So we had people selling things like sewing machines door-to-door in those days, or vacuum cleaners, or selling by mail order. If they didn't sell, they didn't eat. If they didn't get results, they went broke. They had a totally different approach to advertising. To, for instance, one of our clients sold paint and wallpaper. I remember a client I worked on. And I always remember with great amusement that one of the chief things that the agency did was they made sure that on the route that the man took to work and opposite his house, there were always plenty of posters featuring his product. There was nothing to do with measurable results at all. And a lot of it still isn't. I was writing today in Facebook about a campaign that's running in America by Procter & Gamble for Old Spice deodorant. It all features a football player who's very good looking, and they spent millions on a commercial that ran at the Super Bowl, and it attracted a huge amount of attention. In fact, so much attention that this man has made his own little messages in reply to all the people who've commented on the commercials. And more people have actually watched his little messages, his little videos, than the original commercials. And the client, which is Procter & Gamble, won the top award at the Cannes Advertising Festival, which is a sort of backslapping affair which they run every year. But interestingly enough, I found out today that sales are down 7%. I was writing about this the other day, I think, in my blog, and saying, just remember that if your celebrity is more interesting than your product, you're in trouble. It's helping him, but it's not helping you. It's what they used to call a vampire video, sucking the life out of your product.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
That's funny. All right, you have here my first business disaster. When you learn that whatever can go wrong will. Tell me about that.
Bloody-lutely, yeah. Well, after I got this first job, I then got a job as a copy chief and then a creative director at CCPV. And once again, I asked for more money than they were prepared to offer. They offered me a certain amount of money, and I said, no, I want more. And it was a Friday, and I remember the managing director said, well, look, this is a wonderful opportunity. You really should go away and think about it. And I said, well, I do want £500 a year more, so why don't you think about that? On the Monday morning, he rang me up and said, okay, you're on. So I got that job. And at that point, at last, I had the freedom to try and make people do the things that I believe should be done. We already had some clients, such as the British Travel Association, who measured their results because they needed to get rid of brochures to sell holidays. But other clients I would go to and say, you try measuring your advertising. And I can remember there was one client that had sold a material that insulated your curtains. And they'd run an advertisement the previous year, which they were very happy with. And I said, let me try and run an advertisement with a coupon and see what happens. So eventually I persuaded them, and I ran one little ad which ran one paper once, and it got more replies than all their previous year's advertising. And I thought, wow, this is wonderful. And I started to understand the mail order business, and I thought, I must try this. And so I got together with a friend, and we tried to run a mail order ad, which didn't do too well. And then we tried to do another mail order ad.
What were you selling? Insulation?
Well, the first time I was selling little identity bracelets with your initials on them.
Okay.
That didn't work. But the second time, we'd noticed that there was a fashion then in this of the mid-60s for little, what they called wiglets. Which were little wigs, little hair pieces. You remember they used to have these bouffant hairstyles? I thought, let's run an ad for this, you know. So my friend had a good connection, and we got together, and I wrote an ad which ran in the Daily Mirror. And we borrowed his parents' office. His parents' father was a furrier in the fur trade. And we ran the ad, and we went in on the Monday, ran it on the Saturday to see what had happened. We went to his office. We could not open the door. What the hell was the matter? Wasn't the key working? What was going on? And we pushed and pushed, and eventually we got inside. And the reason we couldn't open the door was there was a huge pile of envelopes with money in them. And we thought, bloody hell, we have made it. And I thought, here I am, you know, 25 or 26, I can't remember. I'm going to get rich. We're rich.
Literally, how many envelopes were in there?
I can tell you this much, that advertisement I know was one advertisement was going to make £5,000, which today would be, say, in pounds, probably at least £40,000, say, you know, $60,000 from one bloody advertisement.
Was it a newspaper?
It ran in a national newspaper, the Daily Mirror, one of the two biggest circulation newspapers.
What section did you run it in?
It was run in the ordinary news section, actually.
How big of an ad was it? Just a little display?
It would be about an 8-inch triple, so 8 inches up and then triple column. So we got in there, and we thought this is great, and we thought we'd made it. And the next thing that happened was, obviously, people have to send locks of their hair in that we could match with the hair pieces. And the first thing that went wrong was that the man who was doing the job, a hairdresser, left all the locks of hair on a windowsill, and somebody opened the window, and the wind blew, and all the locks of hair got mixed up. So despite this appalling mess, we made a bit of money. The next thing that happened was the gonist of the hairdresser decided that he would go into the business. So that went wrong. We lost our supplier. It didn't make any money. He tried to copy us. He didn't succeed. We just gave up in despair, and I was really, really upset. But it was a lesson, and I found that you can be fairly certain that whatever will go wrong can go wrong, and quite possibly a few things you can't possibly imagine going wrong will go wrong. And I always say to people, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. You won't be disappointed.
Tell me about your second business disaster.
Oh, the second business disaster. When I was in this agency, they made me an associate director and the creative director. And this agency was famous for being creative. And I wrote a memo, which I wish I'd kept, to the chairman of the board of the company that owned it and said, you should put me on the main board because you're supposed to be a creative agency and I'm the creative director and we're getting bloody good results. It just makes sense. And anyhow, I said, I've done a survey of the top 25 agencies in the world, which I had, and 18 of them are run by ex-copywriters. So he rang up and he said, why don't you come and have lunch with me in the Grosvenor House, which is a very smart hotel opposite our offices. So he took me to lunch at the Grosvenor House and more or less patted my hand and said, calm down there, be patient, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that says you're not very patient. I thought, screw this for a game of soldiers. I'm not going to stick around here. And around about that time, a guy that I'd worked with rang me up and he said, I've got a mail order product that we're wondering if you might be able to help us with. Come and have lunch with me. So I went to have lunch in an Italian restaurant in Paddington called Bizarro. And I said, what's this product? And he said, well, it's a bodybuilding device. And he said, here it is. And I said, I said, show me what you're doing. And he showed me what they were doing. I said, show me the results. And he showed me the results. And I said, I don't know what prompted me to say this, but I just said, look, I reckon I could sell 1,000 a week of these. And he said, if you can sell 1,000 a week of these, we'll give you 20% of the business.
What did the device do? Do you remember?
And this is a very famous product which sold all over the world and quite a few people in America, one or two famous copywriters actually. And one guy interviewed me, the guy called Joe Vitale, who rang me up and said, hey, I bought one of these things and I want you to talk to me about how you did it. Another guy called Clayton Makepeace is also a very well-known copywriter. Said, oh, I bought one of those. A lot of people bought this. It was just an isotonic exerciser. And I wrote ads and direct mail for it, which ran all over the world. And I thought that was onto a very good thing. Until I found out after about 5 or 6 months. So it took me from October to, I think, May to sell 1,000 a week. And they discovered they'd got all their numbers wrong. So the whole business went belly up.
But your advertising was selling about 1,000 a week?
Oh, yeah. It really was a huge success story, even today. I mean, this is like 40-odd years later, more than 40-odd years later.
Was there a brand name for it?
Yeah, it was called the Bull Worker.
So they had their numbers wrong, so you didn't make any money with it?
I made no money, and it was bought by another person that I knew, and I went to this person, and I said, Lenny, how many of these things do you reckon you can sell? He said, well, I don't know, you know, 150 a month or whatever. And I said, listen, I'll tell you what, I've got a deal for you. I said, I'll come along, and if you already sell it, I'll work for you for nothing for 250 a month. I said, but if you sell 250, will you give me, say, a shilling for each one you sell, and so on? And I'd worked out that I would make £60,000 a year if he did the deal I wanted him to do. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. I like that deal. I think we'll do it. And then he rang up his cousin, who is one of the legends of the mail order business, a man called Sam Josefowitz, who lived in a chateau in Switzerland. And his cousin Sam said, no royalty deals. Yeah, because I was going to say, pay me a royalty on everyone you sell above a certain number. And he was quite happy to do it.
Now, had you all the copy that you produced to sell the 1,000 a week, did you own that? Was that yours?
No, I didn't, no.
Were you working as a copywriter for the client?
I was working as a paid consultant.
I see, okay.
But in those days, it was the Wild West. Nobody owned anything, really. And the thing is that they didn't know what I knew. I mean, if they knew what I knew, you never would have said, oh, maybe we could sell 150 a month, you know. I knew precisely what they could sell because I'd got myself a pretty fast education in the mail order business.
Right. But if he had said yes, would you have used the winning elements of your campaign with him?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you've got something that works, you know, you don't have to ask where the gravy train is. It just stops outside your front door. So that was my first, almost made a fortune when I learned, A, don't count your chickens, and B, find out who really makes the decisions. Lenny didn't make the decisions. His cousin did.
Number six, my first lessons in real copy, when you learn from some of the world's best direct response copywriters.
This is, I would say, one of the great, great benefits of that period.
How old are you now?
I'm about 28.
28, okay. Did you just learn about these great copywriters?
No. What happened was, at that time, one of the people at the firm that I was dealing with was a man called David Geller. And David Geller was an incredibly clever businessman. They used to call him the Octopus of Madison Avenue, who did deals with all the mail order operators in the U.S. And as a consequence, people would come over from the U.S. who worked with David Geller, I think mainly just have a look around, maybe see what they could do in England, because the natural first place for people in the States who were looking to make some more money or do something else was to come over to the U.K. because the same language, you know, what was it? Somebody said two countries divided by a common language. So all these people would come over to see what could be done. And I met, in particular, a man called Gene Schwartz. And if you mention the name Eugene Schwartz to anybody today in the online marketing business or in the direct marketing business, Gene Schwartz was generally ranked to be a genius.
Now, how did you meet him? You met him in person?
Yeah, he came along, and he was thinking of running some of his things in England.
He came over to England?
Yeah, he came over because he knew David Geller.
I see.
David Geller had an interest in the Bullworker and in a number of other things.
Did Eugene Schwartz write for David Geller?
Well, the way that business worked is it was a very incestuous business. They all worked for each other. Or they had deals, and one of the things that gave David Geller a lot of strength was that he had interest in one or two publications where he could place advertising for you cheaply so that you could test your ads with David Geller. And he would make money on whatever happened. There was another guy whose name I can't remember, also very, very clever, who owned Ladies Home Journal. Again, you could run ads through him. So it's always a very, very, everybody in everybody else's pocket. So somebody like Gene Schwartz would be running ads with David Geller. Nearly all Gene's ads were actually to sell books of one kind or another. And he took a bit of a shine to me because he was a great lover of modern art. And he actually introduced me to modern art. He took me to an art gallery to look at Robert Rauschenberg's works. I think he used to spend all the money he got on mail order on modern art.
How old was Schwartz at that time?
I would say he was probably about 8 years older than me. He died young, unfortunately.
Yeah.
He's a wonderfully enthusiastic man, and he said, why don't you write for me, kid? You know, why don't you write some copy for me? He said, here's a book. Why don't you see if you can write some copy for this book?
What book?
Well, the book was called The Art of Selfishness, and I can remember I worked on it, and I came up with a headline, which pretty much said, is this the most immoral book you ever read?
Okay.
Gene smiled, and he said, would you like to see the headline I've written? So I said, yeah. And the headline he'd written was, is this the most immoral book you've ever read?
Really?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. And he said, wouldn't you like to work for me? I said, I can't compete with you. I think this is a big mistake on my part. I would have learned a lot. It's a mistake I made twice. A few years later, there's a man called Joe Carbo, also an absolutely brilliant copywriter, who wrote a marvellous headline, which has been copied by just about everyone, which was The Lazy Man's Way to Get Rich. Been copied by lots and lots of people, and he also offered me a job. He said, why don't you come and work for me? And I said, oh, I can't compete with you. That's a cowardly streak in me, which I regret.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. You weren't really going to be competing with them, were you?
I don't know. I just felt overshadowed, you know. I think now as I'm old and people say to me, so looking back on your life, what do you regret? And I think, well, I've done pretty well. But I think I didn't aim high enough.
Was that the first and only time you met Eugene Schwartz, or did you have any other?
No, he came over a number of times, so I met him a few times, and there were other guys that I met. There was a guy called Ed Axel, who used to amuse me quite a lot, who wrote the most hilarious advertisement for a product called Slumber Slim. And I learned lots of tricks from these guys. His thing for Slumber Slim, he had this marvelous headline. It said, lose weight while you sleep through the miracle of auto-oxidization. And I looked at him and I said, Ed, I said, what is auto-oxidation? He said, sweating, kid, sweating.
Oh, my God.
His guarantee was wonderful. His guarantee was, if this book doesn't do everything that we tell you, just tear the cover off and send it back to us and we'll give you your money back. And, of course, this was an absolute encouragement for people to cheat. And it's always a good idea to let people screw you a little bit if they pass by.
Had Eugene Schwartz run into any of his legal entanglements at that time, or was that after?
He certainly had his problems. I mean, I wasn't following it in great detail, but I remember this hilarious story about the fact that he had one problem where I think he'd gone broke, in effect, or a business had gone broke, but he started running out somewhere else. And I remember he had to climb into his old office to get stock to sell. I mean, there was another guy called Monroe Kane, who's another guy I learned a lot from. I was looking at one of his advertisements.
Was Monroe Kane a U.S. guy?
Yeah, they're all American. There's no doubt the people who do it best are Americans. I count myself a mere amateur compared to some of these guys. Monroe, now the thing is, when you write an advertisement, you have a line above the headline that makes some sort of a promise. Then you have the main promise in the headline, then you'll have another something underneath it which elaborates upon the promise. I'm simplifying, but I noticed with Monroe that his overline said pretty much the same thing as his headline, which said pretty much the same thing as his subhead. And I said to him, why do you do that, Monroe? And he said, listen, kid, he said, when you've got a good promise, he said, repeat it as often as you can. So I learned something from him. But the other thing that amused me about him was that he was one of these guys that the minute he started writing, his imagination ran away with him. So he used to come over to England two or three times, and he'd come over with this rather distinguished-looking elderly gentleman who didn't say very much. And I said to my English associates, I said, well, who's that guy that's with Monroe? And they said, that's his lawyer. He makes more money than he does by keeping him out of jail. They were a bunch of scamps.
Hey, listen, I've got a list of some of the old-time, supposedly great advertising and copywriting guys. Can I list some names and just off the top of your head, you know, make a couple comments about each one of them? Maybe even a story. How about John Caples? Did you ever meet him?
I wish to God I'd met John Caples. Over dinner one evening in Frankfurt, David Ogilvy, whom eventually, of course, I got to know extremely well, he said, Rosser Reeves and I were talking one night and we agreed that we'd learned everything we knew from John Caples. And I turned to David and I said, well, all I can say is I'm a second-hand thief because I've learned everything I know from you and Rosser Reeves, which is not strictly true because I used to read John Caples regularly. John Caples was the man, he wasn't the man who originated testing, but he was the man who systematized it and wrote down what he learned better than anyone else. And I would say that anybody who wants to succeed in any kind of marketing should read John Caples, and not just read him, but reread him. He was a very quiet, gentle man. In fact, the man who was in partnership with me later on did meet him. Very quiet, quietly spoken.
Did he own his own agency?
He never owned his own agency.
So he was just a copywriter?
He was a copywriter with an agency called Batten, Barton, Durstin & Osborne. BBD&O, which W.C. Fields described. He said, it's a name which sounds like a man dragging a heavy trunk down a flight of steps, which, strangely enough, was run by a man who may well have been a better copywriter than him, the man called Bruce Barton.
Yes.
Again, a remarkable person. BBD&O, I mean, it's a very incestuous world, in fact. I'm curious to know what other names you're going to come up with. But, for instance, Rosser Reeves, the man who developed the concept of the unique selling proposition, the USP that people talk about, I nearly became his creative director much later on. Somebody wrote to me and said, would I be interested in working for Rosser Reeves?
How about Claude Hopkins?
Claude Hopkins is the man. If there are two people that people ought to study if they really want to understand the essential principles of this business, they are Hopkins and Caples. In fact, if anybody goes on my website, I offer a thing called 101 Helpful Marketing Ideas, and I also say, and you can also download this book free, and this is a 48-page book called Scientific Advertising, written by Claude Hopkins in 1926. Which remains, in my view, the best book ever written on the subject of advertising or marketing, and also the briefest. He was an interesting fellow. He was hired by an agency called Lord and Thomas in 1904 at a salary which today would be equivalent to well over $2.5 million when there was no tax. And eventually he was doing so well that if anyone wanted him to work for them, he would only do so if he was given shares. He was an absolute genius. He made it so simple. So he was definitely the godfather of intelligent advertising.
Okay, John E. Kennedy.
Now, John Kennedy was the predecessor to Claude Hopkins. Lord & Thomas was a very interesting agency. Lord & Thomas was an agency which was joined by this young man called Albert Lasker towards the end of the 19th century. Albert Lasker was a very curious and inquisitive mind. The first thing he did when he really got involved in advertising was he asked a very obvious question. You know, the obvious is always overlooked. So he asked an obvious question. And that question was, what is advertising? What is advertising? And at that time, there were all sorts of sort of rather vague statements about advertising, such as the biggest agency at that time was called AJ Ayer, and they said the secret of success is keeping everlastingly at it. But there was no clear definition of advertising. And so Lasker was going around saying, can anyone define advertising for me? And his office was above a bar in Chicago, a saloon. And one day he was just sitting in his office late at night, and somebody in the bar downstairs sent a card up, which had written on it, I understand you want to know what advertising is. If you send this card back down to me, I will come up and tell you. So Lasker sent the card down, and the man who came upstairs was a tall, very striking-looking Canadian, an ex-Mountie, called John E. Kennedy. And he looked at Lasker and he said, advertising is salesmanship in print. And it was on this principle that Lord & Thomas became the world's biggest advertising agency. And Claude Hopkins was Kennedy's successor. Kennedy did not enjoy good health and died relatively young. A yard away from me right now, I have a photostated copy of a book written by John E. Kennedy called The Book of Tests, in which they talked about the importance of testing. So that's who John E. Kennedy was.
Robert Collier.
Robert Collier is a man who wrote, in my view, the best ever book on the subject of letter writing. In fact, I think all the Robert Collier letter book, marvellous writer of sales letters. And the funny thing is, about 2 years ago, I was having lunch with somebody, and I'd written a book called How to Write a Sales Letter That Sells. And this man said to me, that is the best book ever written on the subject. And I said, oh, no, it isn't. The best book ever written on the subject is the Robert Collier letter book. And he said, no, he said, your book is better than that. I've never been so flattered in my life.
Oh, really?
He was wrong. He was wrong, but nevertheless, I could stand him saying it all day long. As you know very well, because doing the sort of thing you do is creative, and you know that good creative work comes from studying what other people are doing. I do a lot of interviews myself, you know, and when I'm interviewing people, I model my interviews on a very, very fine interviewer in this country called John Freeman, who did a wonderful series of television interviews. And when I'm writing, I always study what other people have done. I don't copy it directly, but it's a good starting point. I mean, after all, you know, when Mozart wrote great music, he did it because he'd studied particularly the Italian composers and Bach and so on.
Tell me something about John Freeman. What's something about his interviews that you admire, that you model?
Oh, my God. Well, John Freeman was very, very gentle. And he did this series of things called Face to Face. And what was interesting is about it, the only face you ever saw, apart from his at the beginning, was the face of the person that he was talking to. And the camera would focus very, very closely on this person's face. And he would very, very gently ask them questions. And he managed to break down some of the toughest people or the most difficult people you can imagine, just gently probing questions. And he himself was almost invisible. And I've never forgotten this. Because, you know, the play of emotions on somebody's face, extraordinary. I remember in particular, he did an interview with the great novelist Evelyn Waugh, who I believe is one of the two greatest English comic novelists of the 20th century, but an extremely unpleasant man. Very bad-tempered and generally a bully, but John Freeman virtually reduced him to tears. Waugh, apparently very public as a writer, was a very private man, and he had undergone a period where he thought he was going mad, and he'd written a book about it called The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold. And it's a very, very delicate subject, but John Freeman managed to get him to talk. He was very good at that.
These were televised interviews?
Yes.
I wonder if they're on YouTube.
I don't know. It's a very good question. They're back in the 60s.
So he was a UK guy. You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Yeah. Although, in fact, he became the British ambassador to Washington. He was a very distinguished man himself. If you're interviewing people, I'm sure you can get to interview many people because you've got a reputation and you're amongst the most listened to people on the internet.
Okay, so we're on the one, my first lesson in real copy, where you learn from some of the world's best direct response copywriters. Do you want to expand on that?
Those were the people I learned from. I just learned lots of tricks from them. And I learned that what I was doing before was not really selling, that these guys really knew how to sell. Well, when I hire copywriters myself, as I have done over the years, people ask me, what do I look for? And there's something I was never looking for then, but I always look for now. And I always say, I look for a burning desire to take money off people. And I think I learned to put passion into my copy, the real desire to sell to people. It raised my game.
My first business partnership, when you learn that appearances often matter more than reality, and three equal partners usually fall out.
What happened was I got this job because after this business, business went broke, the one I was mentioning, the wool worker business, and my plan to make a lot of money failed again. I went to work for an agency called Papert Koenig & Lewis, which was the first ever agency to go public. It was an American agency in London, and I got a job because Charles Saatchi, who became very famous later on, wanted more money than me. And I left that agency because the place was like a lunatic asylum, and went into partnership with two other people in a creative consultancy. And the thing I learned there was that I thought I was doing a fantastic job, because as far as I was concerned, what people wanted was results, and everything I did got results. But the two other equal partners ganged up on me, really, and they ganged up on me because of appearances rather than reality, because they said, look, you come into the office whenever you please with your little dog. People must have thought I was gay, actually. I used to walk around with a poodle. You ponce in here with your white poodle around about 10:30. You sit down and you write a bit of copy, and then you go off to the wine bar. And that's it. We think that's not right. I said, you're in charge of getting the business. This is to one of them. I said, you're the art director and I'm the copywriter. Can I ask you a question? Does my copy work? And they said, yes. And I said, has it ever failed? And they said, no. I said, have any clients complained? And they said, no. I said, what the hell are you talking about? But I left, because what mattered to them was that I just showed up, you know. As far as I was concerned, what mattered was, did I get results? So I took my money in a rage, very little money. As it happens, I'd been approached by a young man, and this is my first experience of building a business. A young man rang me up and he said, you don't know me, he said, but I know all about you. And he was a young man of 21. He really knew what was going on in the mail order business. He said, look, he said, I've got a client. He worked for an agency. And I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, I can tell you which advertisements you wrote. I said, can you? And he said, yes. I said, well, tell me. So he did. He said, you wrote those bull worker advertisements. And then he said, and I know that you're looking for a mail order business. And I said, you're right. And he said, why don't you come and have a drink with me? So I did. Said, I've got a client who is going broke because he spent too much money. And he wants to leave the country in a hurry. But he's got this business, which I believe could make money. He just hasn't been handling it right. So I said, explain to me what it is. So he explained to me. So I said,
You got to tell me, what was it?
It was a course that taught you to play the piano. And the thing about it was that it had been featured on television, and somebody on a well-known television sort of reality show had taken the course for 6 weeks, and the promise that the course made was that if you take this course for 6 weeks, you will play the piano correctly and well. And this guy had done it, and he'd sat down in front of millions of people, and he played the piano correctly and well. So it was fantastic. And I thought, bloody hell, if we can't sell this, we're really in trouble. And so I said, very interesting. And I took all my savings, and I paid for the guy who owned the company to leave the country in a hurry, in exchange for which he gave me the business.
All right, let me ask you this. Had you known about the famous piano ad?
Oh, yes, yes. The John Capel's piano ad. They laughed when I sat down at the piano.
Was that in the top of your head?
Not at all.
Okay.
It literally just said, you can play the piano correctly and well in 6 weeks or all your money back instantly without question. Something like that.
Let me ask you this. Had you known that Eugene Schwartz, one of his very first infomercials that he wrote was called The Piano Man, where they sold piano courses through TV, television, infomercials?
Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Michael, you are a genius. I'm very disturbed when people tell me things I don't know. I'm not sure we shouldn't terminate this conversation now. I am extremely impressed.
I don't know if that was before you met him or after.
That would be before. One of the other people I met, incidentally, since you sent me off on a tangent here about television, I met a guy called Charlie Casher. Now, I live on the King's Road in Chelsea, and near my flat there is a shop that sells movie posters. And in that shop, there is a poster for a film featuring Michael Caine. And the producer of that film is Charles Casher. Mm-hmm. Charlie Casher made all his money out of TV, direct response television, in the good old days, doing 30-minute television commercials in exactly the same way as I imagine Gene Schwartz did. I met so many of these people, I couldn't remember them all. But no, I didn't know that at all. How interesting.
Well, about 5 years ago, I did a recreation of a Eugene Schwartz speech that he did with Phillips Publishing, and I hired an actor, and this actor was phenomenal, and he played the part of Eugene Schwartz. So he did a reading all the way through of the transcripts, and we added a few things in there. And then just recently, about 2 weeks ago, I finished a recreation with the same actors, and we did a recreation of the Eugene Schwartz speech that he did to Rodale. I put it up on my site. I'll send you a link to it. And
now, what's the second? I've seen this, but I haven't looked at it.
Yeah, listen to it, because it sounds better. All we had was the videotape of him speaking in Rodale, but we took the transcripts and we added a little stuff, kind of made it our own and did a recreation of it. It's an audio download, but it's very good. And I think in the Phillips speech, he talks about that he was doing one of the very first infomercials. So I can send you both those. You can check them out. They're great stories in there.
I'd love to.
All right, so continue on. What happened with that?
Oh, yeah, but then, of course, the problem was the agency said, you can't advertise. This guy has too much money. So I went to the chairman of the agency and I said, look, if I pay you up front for the advertising, will you let me advertise? So he said, yeah, all right. So we ran an advertisement. We'd had long discussions with my partner, Martin, who is the guy who brought the business to me. And I said, you know, I think the mistake they're making here is that what he was selling was a paper course. And then after he bought the paper course, then after 6 weeks, he would sell you a set of records. And I said, I think the time to sell a set of records is almost immediately. So we changed everything and sent out the paper course. And then almost immediately afterwards, we sent out something saying, would you like to buy the records? So that made the thing twice as profitable. And then we thought, we're being idiots, let's just sell the record course right from the start. And that was really making money. And that's where, if I'd been smart, I would have said, right, this is good, this is the foundation of our business, let's carry on in this field. And what we did do was we started trying to do too many things at once. And there are two lessons here, actually. When I say my second business partnership, the 50-50 partnership I had with Martin, we were wonderful friends. He was a wonderful guy. He was very, very clever. But neither of us had control, and I couldn't control him. And he was very, very easy on spending money. And he spent too much money. But I couldn't control him. And I decided that, you know, if you're going to have a partnership, unless you're very lucky, 50-50 is a very, very dodgy situation because nobody really has control. That was definitely a big mistake. And then the experience I had of building a business, which is what we did next, was that every time I saw something I liked the look of, I would have a go.
You wanted to sell it?
Oh, no. I wanted to try it. We've got a mail order business. Let's try this business. Let's try that business.
Oh, I see.
Try the other business. So in no time at all, in less than 2.5 years, we had a newsletter. We had a mailing house that sent out stuff for people. We had a little studio where people could go and record themselves singing songs to backing tracks that we had pre-recorded. We got all sorts of things.
Did you have employees at that time, or was it just you two doing
it? Oh, yeah. We had quite a few employees. We had 3 offices. And we were making a lot of money. But as I say, we were trying to do too many things. We couldn't keep our eyes on these things. And one of the things, bringing it to point number 10, the 3 big mistakes that almost ruined me, one of the things I looked at was a newsletter. It was a newsletter called the Business Ideas Letter. And it was up for sale, and I was fascinated by it because of my background in journalism.
Who owned it?
It was owned by a man, and if I'd known him, I never would have bought anything from him, because he was a man about 10 times smarter than me, called Sylvester Steyn. And Sylvester was a South African who'd forgotten more about bloody newsletters than I'll ever know. So what you should do if you buy a business from somebody is ask them what they think are the secrets of success. But what most people do, and I've seen this time and time again, is they buy the business and they think, oh, now I've got this thing, I can change everything. Absolute lunacy. So I got this newsletter and I thought, right, it doesn't really look very good, so let's make it look better. So I made it look a little bit more like a magazine. That is the first massive mistake with a newsletter, yeah? The nature of a newsletter is totally different to the nature of a magazine. The newsletter is like inside information that nobody else can have. And I've done a speech about this, actually, in 1 or 2 countries, where I compare a well-known newsletter, which is published by a friend of mine, with the most popular magazine in Britain, which is called Gratia, which is a women's magazine. And I say, look at this women's magazine. It costs you £2. You can buy it anywhere. It's full of wonderful pictures. It's got great writing in it. It's got 120 pages in it, full of advertising. It's fascinating. It's hugely successful, makes a lot of money. And as I say, it costs £2, read by millions.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What's newsletter?
The newsletter is called Subscription Strategy, and it's about how to generate subscriptions, a very specialized area.
Okay.
It's very specialized. It's only 16 pages long. It's double-spaced, typed in courier. It comes out only six times a year, and it costs £187 a year.
Who writes it?
This guy, Peter Hobday, a friend of mine. In fact, I'm on the editorial board of it. I said, on the face of it, this is insane. People are paying far, far more for this piece of printed junk as opposed to this beautiful magazine, because the nature of the things is totally different. One of them is a mass publication for everybody, whereas a newsletter is full of secrets, inside stories, and this, that, and the other. So never, never make a newsletter look like a magazine. That was the first mistake I made. The second mistake I made, which was, if anything, even bigger, was that I was so pleased with the changes that I'd made, and my partner and I were both very pleased with ourselves, and the publication was so marvellous, and they had a huge list of people who'd inquired but not bought. Obviously, we couldn't fail, could we, by sending out a mailing with the magazine to say, look at this wonderful newsletter, you should subscribe. Now, the second big mistake, never, ever send the publication out if you're trying to sell a subscription, because the publication can never live up to all the wonderful things you could say about it. Number two, it's bloody expensive to send out the publication as well. So that was my second mistake. But even if that were not enough, I managed to cap it even better. We sent the mailing out on the 12th of December. Absolutely insane. Everyone's out celebrating. Nobody's reading anything. The kiss of death, we nearly went broke. So that was a big, big lesson. Big mistakes you shouldn't make. I think the biggest mistake of all was not what I did. It was the conceit. I think one of the big, big problems with business, the big problem, and I see it all the time, particularly in mergers and acquisitions, which are mostly done for reasons of ego, people do things for reasons of ego. So I should have gone to Sylvester Stain, who was far cleverer than I was, and said, Sylvester, you know, what's the trick with this publication? And I should have asked him why he wanted to sell it as well. But I was just stupid. I was a stupid fool. One of the things I could say about myself, when I was very, very young, my mother had a friend, well, she had a lover, actually, who was a wonderful doctor from Vienna. And she told me this after he died, Louis Vertheim, wonderful man. And she said, Louis was very fond of you. And I said, really? I never knew it. And she said, well, he was. And she said, he once said something very interesting to me. And I said, what was that? And she said, Louis said to me, that boy will do very well, but only when he is much older.
Well,
I'm 73 now, and I'm hoping to get successful fairly soon.
You will.
I had this ego, you see. I thought I was wonderful.
When I hear you talk about magazines, and then I've heard you talk about Bill Jamie. Tell me about Bill Jamie.
Bill was wonderful. Bill approached me quite out of the blue. I don't know how the hell he'd heard of me. I think he'd gone to people and said, who's the top copywriter in the UK? And this was 1979, and I'd just started my public speaking career. And he said, will you come and talk with me at a convention in Monte Carlo, in Monaco? And I went to Monaco, and we did a thing together, and I learned a hell of a lot from him. First of all, because he was an absolutely brilliant speaker. He was extremely funny, and one of the things about most people who speak about business is that they are bloody boring. And I learned then, not that it surprised me, but I determined then that if I was going to be a good speaker, I was going to be extremely entertaining. And my old boss, David Ogilvy, used to say, you can't bore people into buying, and you can't bore people into learning. So Bill was terribly witty. This witty didn't just come over in his speaking, although I do remember some of the things I heard him say just make me roar. Somebody said to him, so how do you feel about long copy, Bill? And Bill smiled and paused, and he said, well, he said, nobody ever complained that Gone with the Wind was too long.
But that wittiness was in his copy too, right?
That's what I was going to say, is that this came out in his copy. I remember I went to visit him and his partner in San Francisco, and we spent a couple of hours going through all his old files, and he gave me lots of stuff to take away. And there was one thing he wrote for Andy Warhol's Interview magazine, which I thought was vastly clever and funny. It began with, when they seat you next to Bette Midler at dinner, do you ask her what her brother Bobby's doing, and so and so and so and so, or do you just say, could you pass the salt, please? So he had these really wonderfully deadpan wit.
I know he made money and he charged those big upfront fees for doing the copy, but do you know if, like, the Warhol magazine was successful? Were all his pieces winners?
I don't believe that all of anybody's pieces were winners. In fact, I know that all of his pieces were not winners. The reason I say that was Bill had three prices he charged. his minimum price when I knew him really well was $20,000. And that was just for writing the copy. If the copy beat what it was tested against, it was $30,000. If it was a new publication and it beat what it was tested against, it was $40,000. So the clear implication, obviously, is that it didn't all...
So a lot of people came to Jamie, people who wanted to start publications, new publications, so there was really nothing to test it against.
Yes, in a lot of cases. But I'm going back to what you were saying about interview. Oddly enough, I was saying that in something I put out 2 or 3 days ago, that Bill was widely regarded as the best copywriter of his time. And Denny Hatch sent me something today saying, I beg to disagree. And I sent something back and I very carefully didn't say I thought he was the best copywriter of his time. I actually thought he had a very narrow compass. And Bill himself said, I write for people like me, which is wonderful. But, I mean, that's all right if you can do that. But well, I was going through about 7 different pieces of copy that I've written myself with Perry today, and I started by talking about something that sold for £1.99, which is a model of a London bus. And I also mentioned I've written copy to sell the Ebb, which is an aeroplane that sells for millions of dollars. So I sell an enormous range of things. In fact, that's the only damn thing I would say about myself, is I've sold about just about anything you can think of, with quite a few things you can't. But America tends to be more specialised, but certainly Bill only did one thing, you know.
He did magazines.
Gene Schwartz, I was unaware that he'd sold the piano, of course, but when I knew Gene Schwartz, and just about any of the copy that you see for Gene, it's to sell publications, yeah?
Right, right, right.
You take Clayton Makepeace again, he specialises in certain areas. John Carlton the same. The only thing I would say is that I don't specialise. You want to sell it, I'll flog it for you.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. Okay, look, we're on number 11. My first dealings with real crooks when I learned, again, to keep an eye on the money.
And one of the things we discovered was that the hit parade in Sweden was about 70% the same as the hit parade in England, but about 2 or 3 months later. So what we did was we did copies of British hits, and we put them into racks in newsagents in Sweden so that we could be there with copies of the hits that were about to appear. It's quite a good idea, except that the guy we put in charge of it, I remember to this day, a guy called George Tauber, was a bloody thief and ripped us off something shocking. He was such a charming man, I couldn't believe it until we actually saw the figures, and we saw that he was stealing like mad. We should have been making money and we weren't, and we could have been in serious legal trouble. I always remember going over to see him, and he used a weapon which I recommend to anybody who's really in trouble.
What?
We taxed him with it, he just sat there and cried.
Really?
So he cried, and then there was another guy, there were quite a few of these rogues who came over, they were the real suede shoe artists who came over from the States. And some of these guys get businesses which eventually are going to be very good, but they rob them blind, so they never get off the ground. So this guy had the idea of going into the German market and selling frozen food by delivery, which was not a bad idea. It's a perfectly valid business model. And the trick was you sold people the freezer to put the frozen food in, and one way or another you made a lot of money. And I put about £20,000 into that business, and boy, that managed as well. So I got well ripped off. I was a very trusting person, very, very trusting. One of my partners in the eventual business that I did do well, which was the advertising, the direct marketing agency, said, listen to my stories, and I'd known him for a long time, and he quoted to me Daniel Defoe in Robinson Crusoe, who said, the mariner to sail with is he who has been shipwrecked, for he knows where the reefs are. I was learning where all the reefs were at first, and considerable personal expense. I should have kept an eye on the money. The next thing that happened to me was, one of the things that we were making an absolute bloody fortune on was selling fire extinguishers. This was a deal I discovered by watching what David Geller was doing in America. What he was doing was selling fire extinguishers through door-to-door agents. And the deal was that you sold the agents the fire extinguishers and said, you can make so many dollars a week. If you don't succeed, just send them back. We'll give you money back. Now, this is based on a very simple fact of human psychology, which is that people think they can sell them, can't be bothered, feel ashamed and don't ask for their money back. Well, we went into this business and we were making a absolute bloody fortune.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. You're selling an opportunity.
I was selling an opportunity, and it was doing extremely well. And then one day, there was an article in a national newspaper called The People, which has had millions of readers, which said that these fire extinguishers we were selling, which were actually aerosol fire extinguishers, that was interesting, they were among the first aerosol fire extinguishers, were dangerous. And that they tested these extinguishers with some firemen, and they got photographs, and they were dangerous. And of course, my cash flow went right into reverse.
Oh my God.
And by the most bizarre coincidence, there was a girl who was working for me. She was really the editor of the business ideas letter, which by that time we'd managed to sort out. She said, "You're not going to believe this." She said, "But this newspaper actually used some firefighters from Wimbledon, which is where I live, and I know these firefighters, and the tests were rigged." They were prepared to testify that they were rigged. And furthermore, the newspaper said, "These extinguishers do not adhere to British standard number 1562A. And the thing was, there was no British standard for aerosol fire extinguishers. It was a rigged test, and it referred to a standard that didn't exist or was not relevant. So I then went to a lawyer near Fleet Street to say, "Look here, you know, what do you think about this?" And the lawyer put his fingers together in a steeple in the way the lawyers do and looked at me over them and said, "You will undoubtedly recover, Mr. Bird." And I said, "What do you mean, I will undoubtedly recover?" And he said, "You will undoubtedly recover damages, considerable damages." And I said, "Considerable like what?" And he said, £45,000, something like that. I said, "Oh, that's good." I said, "So how long will that take?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "these newspaper johnnies, you know, they tend to stick these things out. I'd say a couple of years." "Bloody hell, I've been broke in 6 weeks." He said, "Well, that's, I'm sorry about that. My fee is so-and-so." And I was broke in 6 weeks.
So you didn't hire him?
Waste of time. I didn't have the money. We used to spend our nights in discotheques. The sort of sex life that people dream of. I used to wake up every morning and go to the pub in Shepherd Market and drink champagne. It was wonderful while it lasted. As I said, my first experience of being libeled when I learned you can't beat people with big pockets and no scruples. And we went broke. And what happened then? So I learned a tremendous amount from. Well, from some of the rogues that I'd met, I met a very, very sharp accountant. And the accountant came up to see me in his Rolls Royce. And I said, "What should I do?" And the first thing was that we'd done all sorts of things with our expenses that we shouldn't do. And he said, "First thing you want to do is to lose your books." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Just say you left them in the car and somebody stole them." I said, "I can't say that." He said, "Why not?" I said, "It's not true." He said, "Well, who can prove that it's not true?" Now, I should have taken his advice, but I didn't. And then the next thing he said, "Since you're going broke," he said, "make sure you can steal as much money as you can out of the business."
Okay.
And I said, "No, I don't really want to do that." And then I said, "So tell me what's going to happen." Eventually, I went to a lawyer who specialized in liquidations or companies going broke and asked his advice. And I said, "Tell me how this happens when a company is liquidated." And he said, "There's a creditors meeting. And they all get together and they vote on who is going to be the liquidator." I said, "What is the liquidator?" And he said, "The liquidator is the person who takes your assets and sells them." And he said, "What you want," he said, "is a joint liquidation, or even better, your own liquidator, who will look on you very favourably and not pry too carefully into some of the things you've done in terms of whether you paid your tax right, whether your expenses were right, de-da-de-da-de-da." When he'd explained it to me, he said, "You'll never get your own liquidator," he said, "because the Inland Revenue, the IRS in America, they are the main creditors. They're never going to give you your own liquidator." I then went around London and I'd go to friends of mine and I would say, "Hey, would you like to be a creditor?" And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "All you have to do is to give me a bill for services rendered, which I won't pay, so I will owe you money. And come to the creditors meeting and vote for me. And also, here are one or two things you might like to say to the people who are trying to get the liquidation." And what I discovered was that all these people in the liquidation business were crooks. And that what they would do is they would take the assets and sell them off very, very cheaply and pocket a lot of money. And they didn't give a damn about the creditors. And the creditors would never get any money or very little. And when it came to the day of the creditors meeting, my partner, Martin, was so frightened he wanted to leave the country. And I said, I was terrified, but I said, "Well, I'm going to stick it out." Because there were a lot of very angry people. And one guy, "Come along, he said, I'm going to break your legs."
Yeah.
I was frightened. But eventually, I sat down and made the best speech of my life up to that point. And I looked at everyone and I said, "I'm very sorry about this. We didn't intend this to happen. But I'm looking around the room, and as far as I can make out, everybody is over 18 and most of you are over 21. So you're old enough to understand that, you know, sometimes businesses go wrong. We're very, very sorry, blah, 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 blah." And I got my shills, the people that I'd recruited to ask the main villain. There was a man called Phillips who was famous for defrauding creditors,
right,
trying to get the liquidation. So when he stood up and asked questions, I got my people at the back saying, "Tell me, Mr. Phillips, how much did the creditors get from your last liquidation?"
What did he say?
He sort of... And we got a joint liquidation.
That's good.
And a man came up to me, a very famous advertising man in England, and he came up, shook me by the hand, and he said, "I'd like to shake you by the hand, Drayton," he said, "because undoubtedly one day you will be a millionaire." Which, of course, in those days, a million was quite a lot of money. And so I was very heartened. Lots of people turned up, and I managed to survive. And then I spent the next 7 years going mad. But the lesson that I could have learned from this was very, very important. My lesson 13, I learned to keep my businesses separate. I had all the businesses under one umbrella. Absolutely bloody fatal. I had an 8-year lease on number 100 New Bond Street. And I think most people have heard of what Bond Street in England, the shopping centre at Shopping Street in London. Just owning that lease, I could have lived off that for 20 years. Yeah? But it went down with everything else and was sold by this ghastly liquidator, who's actually, the day after the liquidation, his cousin came in and said, "Take a look at the furniture." They never even looked at the books.
Right.
Absolute rogues. But there I was saddled with massive debts after the fall that the group of companies went broke. I mean, in February of that year that we went broke, I was in the Times Business News as one of, you know, the coming businessmen of today. And I owed so much money to the tax people. And I'd married a very beautiful girl who was a Maori princess from New Zealand, but had also actually left New Zealand. Very beautiful. She looked very like Ava Gardner. And she'd gone to Australia. She'd been a top model. And she was an extraordinarily talented person. The year before I met her, she was voted top model in Australia. She was a world-class dancer with the Catherine Dunham Ballet. She was extremely able and talented. And I met her and fell in love with her, but she was as mad as a hatter.
Did you have children with her?
No. The whole thing was the saddest experience of my life, to be honest, because I fell in love with her, she fell in love with me, and I didn't realise until about 6 months after the marriage that she suddenly went completely bananas and started attacking me and God knows what. And I stayed with her for 7 years, but one of the problems was that the previous husband had been a millionaire, and she really knew how to spend money. And I had no money, and I couldn't work under my own name because I owed so much money to the tax people. So between 1970 and 77, I operated financially and personally under a false name. I was David D. McMahon, as far as the banks were concerned.
David D. McMahon. Okay.
And that was the name of her previous husband, was McMahon. What was really funny about it. But these 7 years were very valuable to me. My second experience of a firm going broke, this happened because I was approached by the man who'd invented the bull worker, a man called Dirk Kerbel, who was a very, very clever man, also a bodybuilding expert. In fact, we used to use Cassius Clay as a young one for our advertising for the bull worker. And he approached me and he said, "I've got a new product. Would you like to sell it?" And I said, "Yes." And I took the product and I started selling it, and it was going like gangbusters. And then two things happened. One was a mistake of mine, and the other was something I had no control over. We were importing these things from Germany, and I had no control over the fact that in April, suddenly the pound took a nosedive against the Deutschmark. I mean, really took a nosedive. It was devalued considerably, by about 20%. So my cost-to-sale ratio went up a spell. But previously I'd made a decision which proved to be fateful, but was a learning experience. I'd been looking at all the response rates I was getting from the various papers I was advertising in. I discovered that one of them, which is called The Sun, was producing inquiries at a far lower rate than any of the others. And I put all my money into it. What I didn't know was that it was also converting at a far lower rate than all the others. So I was hit with a double whammy, and that business went broke. But this was during my 7 years in the wilderness. And one of the things that I say in my notes, I'd learned that you can survive under a false name for a long time, and that doing things you don't like is good for you. I had to do all kinds of things to survive. I sold franchises for swimming pools. I acted as a marketing director for a swimming pool. I wrote parts of books for people. I wrote parts of a book about evolution of the American cowboy. I wrote a book about how the Bugatti motor car developed, part of a book. I wrote part of a book on the world weather. I wrote part of a guidebook for London. I wrote speeches for the chairman of Imperial Foods. I wrote presentations for the Ford Motor Company. I did every bloody thing and anything that people asked me to do to make money, and I hated a lot of it. I sold investments on the telephone. But by God, it was good for me, because when eventually I started, after all these years, my own agency with my two partners, there was very little that I didn't know. I mean, I'd made every mistake you could make. And I'd done just about everything you could do, not necessarily very well, but well enough to give me a fantastic advantage and to overcome my natural incompetence, Michael.
Right, it was all good experience.
Yeah. And we started this agency. We had no money, not a penny between us. We all owed money. I owed £10,000 to the tax man. We used to work in the morning before we went for our various jobs, and then at lunchtime, and then in the evening. And in no time at all, we couldn't afford an office. Eventually we borrowed an office, which we never had to pay for. Oh, it was unbelievable. In 3.5 years, we were the biggest in the business, which didn't mean anything, but we really were well known, you know, because we promoted direct marketing like nothing. I mean, anybody who wants me to stand up and make a speech anywhere on the steps of St. Paul's on Christmas Eve, I'd be there. At the opening of the envelope, I'd be there. I used to write 6 columns a month for various publications, for at least 10 years.
Okay, so all of this, these 15 life lessons, were all before your direct response agency.
Yeah.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Please continue to part 2.